This winter, the journalist Erica Heilman drove around the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont and talked with people about class. For years, she said, I've been wanting to make a show about the terrible cultural divides growing in our country, but I couldn't figure out how to do it without getting into boring conversations about politics. So she tried an experiment, going up to people and asking them if they would be willing to talk about an awkward question. Outside a general store, she met a woman named Katrina Patrick and asked her, what class are you? Working class, Katrina said right away. It means we're here to make sure that the rich people get what they want in life. Katrina said this without any of the awkwardness that Heilman anticipated, and I felt her directness immediately, the way she was so clear in her understanding of her place and purpose in the world. I noticed how precise her analysis of our society is, and I noticed how far it felt from my understanding of God's vision for the people God created, living in an abundant garden, working together to care for it. John's account of the Last Supper focuses almost entirely on the moment when Jesus washes the disciples' feet. John says that this happens during supper, as if Jesus sort of stood up while everyone was mid-bite, tied a towel around his waist, and just got into it. This would have been shocking to the disciples, and Peter gives voice to that reaction, refusing at first to let Jesus wash his feet. This isn't because the act itself would have been foreign to him. Foot washing was an essential part of hospitality at the time of Jesus's life. People who visited friends and relatives often traveled by long, dusty walks. Before sitting down at a table and sharing a meal, servants, generally women who were at the very bottom of the hierarchy, would wash guests' feet. When Peter pushes back, he's in part responding to seeing Jesus in the position of an undignified woman, the position of somebody here to make sure that the rich people get what they want in life, rather than to have wants of her own. Jesus makes it very clear that what he's doing here is teaching the disciples how to be in the world. If he, teacher and Lord, washes feet, so can the disciples. And then he says something interesting. Servants are not greater than their master, nor are messengers greater than the one who sent them. What I expected to say, and in fact what I thought he said until I read this passage many times, is that masters are not greater than their servants. He says the opposite. So he shows them that he, a figure of authority, is not above doing the work of a servant. And then he tells them that servants, too, are not above their masters. One thing I take from this is a call for equity rather than vengeance. He tells the disciples it's not enough to know this. You are only blessed if you actually do it. Over the past few days, while I was avoiding writing this sermon, there are things I did without much thought. I spent a lot of time looking at clothing on the internet. I bought fabric to use to make quilts, posted photos of my vacation on Instagram. I thought about what food to buy for dinner. I was not thinking about these things as decisions with stakes. I was just thinking about things I wanted to do or to have. Until I listened to Katrina speak, I wasn't thinking about how in the next state over or the next street over, there are many people for whom these decisions would have much higher stakes or would be inaccessible. Although I live alongside many people who we as a society are comfortable keeping in a position of living to serve the wants of others, After listening to Katrina, I noticed how infrequently I talk deeply with those people, and how, though I give some of my money to those who have less than I do, I almost never actually wash their feet. When Jesus washes the disciples' feet, he already knew he was on the cusp of dying. It would be reasonable for him as a human being to feel terror or grief. John tells us, though, that what Jesus feels is love. Though he knew that Judas would betray him and Peter would deny him, he loved them to the end. When I am afraid, the first reaction I notice in myself tends to be anger. These days, I am afraid for myself and for other women and our ability to access healthcare. I am afraid for trans people, for their safety and ability to thrive. I am afraid for our neighbors who are harassed by the police, some of whom are killed. I'm afraid for kids who are hungry. I'm afraid of climate change. I'm afraid of people seeking asylum, uncertain where they will find peace. When I think of the people who are implicated in creating and upholding a situation where these fears thrive, loving doesn't feel like a particularly accessible response. Instead, I want to hit them. I want to hurt them. I want to scream like an animal. And I don't think that reaction is necessarily wrong or bad, but I notice how far it is from Jesus washing the feet of a person who would have a hand in his death. And I notice that Jesus giving himself to us as an example, himself who is human but also God, feels like a bit of a scam, especially in the moments where I want to scream like an animal. It feels these days that we have very little control over the conditions of the world we live in. But here is another layer. Some of the things I like least about myself, for instance, like the way I buy clothing online instead of focusing on work that is important or meaningful, come in part, I think, from my desire to be seen and loved, and an awareness of the absence of the depth of love that I seek. And I think that's true of many of us, maybe of us all. Whether or not anyone wants to admit it, our need for love and our brokenness in its absence equalizes us all. I have no control over the ways that people respond to this absence, whether they betray one another, deny one another, scream at one another, hurt one another. Sometimes I do each of those things, but I do have control over the choice the next time I feel the absence of love to wash somebody else's feet.